Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. This is the podcast where we talk with top visual effects artists doing cutting-edge work, and we like to dig into the technical side, advance the craft of visual effects, and pay respect to the hardworking people creating amazing work. Be sure to check out all of our other podcasts at fxguide.com/podcasts. Today, we have a bit of a preview of the Scientific and Technical Awards, the Oscars rewarding technical achievements. These awards will be given out on Saturday, February 15th, and today, Mike Seymour is going to speak with Jeremy Salon of Sony Picture Image Works. Jeremy will be receiving a Technical Achievement Award for the development of the OpenColor.io Color Management Framework. This is a framework that enables consistent color visualization of motion picture imagery across multiple facilities and numerous software applications. And if you work in visual effects, you know how important managing color can be. There's a constant flow of new cameras, and productions often mix cameras, which makes this even more challenging. So initiatives like ACES and OpenColor.io are critical as we push toward higher quality imagery. And speaking of those color issues, as you're probably aware, we have a sister site, FXPhD, that offers the best online training at amazingly affordable prices. And this term, we have an advanced digital color theory class with Professor Charles Poynton. This is aimed directly at getting you up to speed with color from onset to post-production, grading, finishing, approval, mastering, distribution, and even display and exhibition. We have courses also in Arnold, matte painting, Nuke, Smoke, Houdini, Mari, Previz. Seriously, so many ways to amp up your skills in areas you know or widen your skills in new ways. So check out all of that over at fxphd.com. So let's jump in. I'm really excited to hear this interview with Mike Seymour speaking with Jeremy Salon.
And thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. And congratulations on being recognized by the Academy for the second year in a row, I might add.
Oh, thanks so much. Yeah, it was pretty exciting. And this year, unexpected.
Well, yes. And, you know, I think it's not without importance that you're recognized individually. A lot of times these are collaborative efforts and there's a team that's put forward. But in this particular case for the Scitex, in terms of Color.io, it's just you that they're acknowledging and thanking. So that's nice.
Yeah, it's very cool.
There's a couple of aspects about this I wanted to discuss. And of course, we'd love to discuss the technical aspects. But before I do, I should touch on the fact that this is very much an open source initiative. And I want to applaud you and the team at Sony for being so having such a leadership position in supporting the open source movement and allowing companies around the world to kind of get a level of standardization.
Thanks a lot. It's all Rob Bredo, originally his idea to open source OpenColor.io, as well as all the other projects we had. And it really made sense for a lot of these technologies, especially the ones that are really based around interoperability with other facilities and other projects and other teams. So it really makes our lives a lot better as well. I guess that's the impetus.
So when did you first start looking at this particular problem, and how did it evolve?
Oh, a long time ago. In I think 2003 and 2004, when I first came to ImageWorks, I started working on color management. And it was a very different facility and different approach to color back then. Really, I was tasked as one of my first projects at trying to bring some standardization in more of a uniform management approach to the chaos. I mean, we had directories with literally thousands of lookup tables, and it was a bit of a mess trying to integrate them into many of our different applications. Back then, we had a custom compositor, a custom lighting tool, a custom image playback tool. And so I first started out on a library that would try to standardize these things, and it was right around the introduction of 3D lookup tables as well into the visual effects and visualization pipelines. So trying to get sort of a uniform way to look at your images across all these applications became the kernel of what became OpenColor.io publicly.
So back then, it seemed to be that if you were talking to someone about color management, it really fell into two camps. The first thing was trying to somehow have standardized monitor calibration, because there was just a general desire back then to make sure, of course, everyone had the monitors set up with a good 1D LUT that was meant they were in alignment. And then, as you say, 3D LUTs were really just a targeting mechanism to try and sort of simulate what was going to happen further down the line. And that was kind of it. That was like it felt like that was the extent of color management when you were discussing the topic, of course.
And it was even worse than that, right? Because when you mentioned the 1D lookup tables, those were usually applied in hardware on the gamma table. So when you would switch to one of these lookup tables, like a log lookup table, like all of your user interfaces would change drastically, other windows you had open.
Yep.
And I mean, God forbid, if you had two different shows or two different lookup tables you had to look at the same time, I mean, you couldn't even hope to A-B two images that were in different image spaces.
Yeah, and if I recall back then, you know, I think it was Apple was running a Gamma of 1.8 and, you know, the PC world was running 2.2. And that was kind of the extent of people's appreciation of Gamma as well. It was just some number that some manufacturer gave you to get the pictures looking right. And not a lot of thought about how it related to the environment that you were looking at the images in.
Yeah, exactly.
So if we run the clock forward to today, of course, color management now is really an entire pipeline problem. And not only that, it's a really detailed issue to deal with the relationship of the acquisition, because the big thing that also shifted between when we were first talking about and today is a greater appreciation at acquisition level because of the digital cinematography that often requires a CMOS gathering of the, I guess, I'm going to say the frequency responses at the chip level before it gets matrixed into an actual color space. How widely do you think that's today understood by artists in facilities generally?
Not that well. I mean, the good and the bad of the success for, I'll call out OpenColor.io, but even other things like it, I think the success is that it decouples what the artists do sometimes from the underlying math, which is nice in that they don't necessarily have to worry or concern themselves. But I think artist education is one of the great areas that could really come up and benefit. I mean, we internally try to teach artists as well as we can. And for all the ones who learn it, I know it just it really is a wonderful benefit to have a sense of what's going on.
We are in a world today where most pipelines are built around a floating point, OpenEXR kind of level. So we're not really worried about colors being clipped in just a bit level so much. That's still is not strictly true at the acquisition level, when there's quite often a crash cam Canon 5D or 1D somewhere that might be producing an H.264 8-bit file. But generally on a professional show, or if stuff's being generated from your renderers, you've got a lot of bits to work with. But talk to me about the color spaces, and in particular how OpenIO, your OpenColor.io relates to ACES, because it's a very wide gamut definition of a color space.
Yeah, very much so. So OpenColor.io and ACES, or more specifically, yeah, the ACES projects are very complementary technologies. So OpenColor.io really has no built-in color workflow assumptions. I think this is one of its strongest suits. And that's if you're a facility that's working with sort of these modern HDR scene linear, as we call them, approaches to color management, great. If you're a company that's using a different approach, such as a more gamma-centric pipeline, it also suits that. So OpenColor.io basically loads all of this information as specified by the artist at runtime, and it'll swap between these different profiles, and it will exactly match however you want it to behave. Now, one of those profiles that OpenColor can use is the ACES workflow. So in that case, you have access to the ACES transformations, the RRT, the reference rendering transform, basically the viewing curves for how to look at this information. So it's very complementary.
So in an ACES workflow, if I was to just characterize this, it's my understanding that you've basically got the scaffolding built by OpenColor.io that may support the particular implementation that I want to run my pipeline, which might be ACES. The important thing being that there are no limitations. Well, there are obviously limitations, but there are no practical limitations coming from either the implementation or, in fact, the incredibly wide gamut that we're working in to do the actual, once we've done the transform into an ACES color workspace.
Yeah, exactly. And you mentioned it being wide gamut. I'd like to clarify that it's actually wide gamut in two ways. First, it's wide gamut in the color sense of the word gamut, right? Where the primaries, the actual red, the green, and the blue, refer to very, very saturated colors. So in that sense, it's wide gamut. But it's also very high dynamic range. And it's the dynamic range is higher than, not all, but some of the people who do visual effects and animation are probably used to working. But I consider the high dynamic range in terms of the tonal scale to be just as important to workflow, if not more important, than the wide gamut primaries in that portion of the ACES pipeline.
It seems to me that the other really important aspect is that you guys are, I'm going to call it, well, it started out that you were sort of LUT agnostic, but now you're kind of you embrace a lot of different approaches, a lot of different ways that people might work, and certainly embrace a lot of variation in the particular model. It's not like open color just sort of defines that I have to go down one particular way of working, one particular set of standards. That being said, one of the things that ACES is ideally been set up to do is to unify multiple source acquisition formats into some kind of common space where one can really do a bunch of transforms and operations, knowing that we've moved everything to sort of common ground.
Yeah, exactly. The IDTs, the input device transforms, I believe it is, for ACES attempt to bring all of the different input devices into a common working space, the high dynamic range floating point EXR-like space known as ACES. But note that it's a moving target, right? I mean, ACES is not a lockdown specification. They keep improving it and making it better. And in that sense, actually having a more flexible pipeline like OpenColor, where you plug these transforms, is actually pretty good.
In fact, Jeremy, have they actually published the final ACES yet?
I don't believe so, not yet.
So we've all run ahead with it, saying, what a great idea, and they haven't actually defined it fully yet.
Well, it's a great idea because it sort of embodies what we've all been doing and all been aspiring to do, right? I mean, to go to the visual effects world and say, yeah, it's essentially going to the visual effects community and trying to sell them on high dynamic range rendering, right? It's an easy sell. The challenge, in my estimation, the largest challenge is the viewing transform, because the viewing transform is very analogous to, say, a print stock. And essentially, if what they're trying to do is choose one print stock that for the next 50 years will look great. And there's a reason multiple print stocks exist even today. And back in the world of film, you might want to choose different stocks for different tonal renditions, different looks. Sometimes different views just look good in different ways. So I think it's a real challenge to come up with the real sort of idealized, perfect, this is how an image should look.
The adoption of OpenColor.io, I mean, obviously started inside Sony because it was something that was developed in-house. But because it's a framework and a setup, it's actually been adopted quite heavily. For example, the Foundry has adopted it. And because at a practical level, you are at the coalface as opposed to kind of a theoretical kind of bunch of drawings and charts and numbers. You're actually helping this actually happen. Can you talk to me about the implementations and people that are using the OpenColor.io?
One of the things I think that its strongest suit is that for programmers and developers who actually want to display images, as well as to do color space conversions, the API is very straightforward. It's no API is like super simple, of course, especially when you want to do some heavy lifting. But we've designed it to keep it as simple as possible. I believe you can actually do rudimentary color transforms in, say, like 6 to 10 lines of code. And that's meaningful work in those 6 to 10 lines of code. So we've actually gotten very rapid adoption from a lot of commercial developers. You mentioned the Foundry. They were wonderful. Katana, actually, because it was an internal Sony tool, shipped even to the version we gave them initially with OpenColor.io support. But then Nuke also came out with support, as well as Mari. So that was a sort of wonderful foot in the door. And it was also sort of a Trojan horse to some degree, right? Because once you support OpenColor.io as a facility in one of your applications, the whole goal for it is that it'll work in all of your applications that use it. So people who wanted to experiment with Katana back in the day, or people who wanted to use Nuke or Mari, would set up OpenColor.io for that application, and then they would just see, well, these 6 other applications support it, so why not just use it to manage the rest of our production pipeline? So it sort of became a slippery slope where the more tools that adopted it, the more advantage there was to using it in the rest of your internal ones as well.
What other products outside the Foundry 3 that you mentioned are adopting OpenColor.io?
RV has included it recently. Vegas Pro, which is an interesting nonlinear editor, uses it. Silhouette, the paint and roto package, does. Even the Blender guys have gotten in on it and integrated OpenColor.io support, which is very exciting.
The thing about OpenColor.io is all the color transforms are loaded at runtime, right? It's very...
Yeah, much... exactly.
Do you want to sort of explain how that works?
Yeah, so the user provides a text file, which we call the configuration. And you can almost think about it as listing names of different color spaces. So when you say the word sRGB, that may mean something to you, but maybe to you that means a certain equation. Maybe to someone else that means gamma 2.2. Maybe on one show I'm doing, it means this specific curve. Maybe on something else, there's a roll-off. So it's basically, OpenColor.io doesn't make the assumption that when you say sRGB, you mean what it thinks. You have to be explicit. So what you do is, in this text file, you say, apply this lookup table, or apply this matrix transform, or apply this equation, then this matrix, then this other equation, then this lookup table. You can basically list in a row the steps that you would like all of your software to take when applying that transform.
Right. So if I like to have sRGB in a 2.4 gamma for working in a very dark cubicle kind of space, but have it at 2.2 when I'm in a client viewing area, then I just specify that and I'm not tied down to one, even though I'm effectively just varying my sRGB.
Exactly. And the exciting part about that is you're only putting that sort of magic information in one file, and all of your applications will match. I mean, with the former approach where, say, you had to do a custom configuration in each one of your pieces of software, it might be very convenient for you to do that in one, but you would never know, like, hey, when my texture painter was loading this up and playing around in Photoshop, are they still going to see that, or do I need to redo that little bit of magic in each one of those applications? So this makes it far more convenient to sort of get color uniformity.
Now, what if somebody sends me a LUT? What if Arri comes out with a new LUT, or a Sony camera comes out with some new LUT for some special sort of mode or something they've got? What do I do?
Yeah, so for one of the things I said you could use as a building block is a lookup table. So the goal is that you, hopefully, OpenColor.io would have support for that lookup table format. We're adding new ones all the time, so if it doesn't, we certainly would go ahead and try to do that very quickly. And then you would just point OpenColor.io at that file and just go ahead and use it. I mean, it really is our goal to sort of support every lookup table format you could imagine ever.
So tell me, the nature of this, you said at the beginning, was somewhat of a surprise to you that you're being recognized by the Academy. But the process for the SciTech Awards is quite different than from the traditional Oscars. This is not like a prize won by a vote on the night. This is a very well thought out process. Can you just go in? I mean, when did you first find out about it?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't be more impressed with the technical explorations that the Academy does with regards to the SciTech investigations. They're very thorough. It's very exciting to be a part of the process. Well, people put out by doing original submissions, and I haven't actually had experience with one of those, but sometime in the mid-summer, I think, they'll put up on the list of a series of categories that are being considered. So this year, for example, the CDL guys, the color decision list,
yep,
had been submitted as a piece of technology to be considered. And so they posted it saying, the Academy SciTech Committee put that online saying, hey, for all competing submissions, they call it, but it's not literally competing. I think they described it, but what I found interesting is they described it in very general terms this year. They described it as a color specification for managing color on motion pictures or something like that. And I read that and I was like, hey, that's exactly what OpenColor does as well. So I was put together, I wouldn't call it a competing submission, but something under the banner of the category that they had opened up. And then you basically wait a few months, and then you get invited back to do a demonstration. I did a demonstration and then didn't hear much back after that, which is why I was very surprised this year to be awarded.
Yeah, and it isn't competing because academies, or I'm going to say the academies, actually it's the ASC, right?
Yes.
Actually was acknowledged as well, so it's not as if you sort of pushed one out.
Yeah, which was sort of wonderful. And I mean, even at we did live presentations of both technologies, and they went up and said great things about OpenColor.io, and I went up and said great things about CDL, because they really don't fill the same niche.
No, CDL is much more of a way of passing, in a kind of broad brush stroke, passing a direction from a cinematographer to a post house through a series of standardized kind of operations. It's far less about trying to manage color through a pipeline.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we as a facility love CDL. We use it. Most other visual effects facilities I know use it as well. I mean, you can certainly use both. It's not an either-or type of approach, which took a little convincing, mind you, of the people. We had to demonstrate that even though I submitted under that banner, it is, in fact, not directly competing, but still under the same broad category. But it was really exciting to be a part of that process and to get a chance to sort of lay it all out.
Just out of curiosity, where do you use CDL? My only question for asking that is that...
Well, because it's used so extensively on set, we often get that on-set information as part of per-shot grades, which we then want to sort of match within OpenColor as a viewing transform. But then we also use it for our plate neutralization and plate timing pipelines. Essentially, if you can think about the sun moving during the day, it's just shot-to-shot color variation that you want to undo for purposes of sequence lighting, and then reapply on the way out. We take advantage of CDL's primary grade capabilities for that.
What's the future for OpenColor.io? There's obviously an ongoing, I'm going to call it almost maintenance function in making sure you're supporting particular formats of LUTs and stuff, not individual ones, but the formats that they're going in and stuff. But are you developing more core technology in this area, or do you feel like you've produced the sort of stable open source initiative and you're sort of stepping back from it now?
Well, we're stepping back a little bit, but I do have some ideas going forward that I think will be very important to do. There's sort of three main things that I think will happen in the short to medium term, which I think will be really nice. One is better GPU support. Right now, the GPU support that's in there is mainly geared towards display. It's not high enough quality to bake it in to, say, like final deliverables. We have one of the third-party vendors who's contributing a piece of technology that will back OpenColor.io by an OpenCL sort of GPGPU approach, which will allow for real-time hardware-accelerated capabilities with the full precision necessary to bake into final imagery. So that's really exciting.
So you mentioned there were three things, but I think we only mentioned one of them. What's the other two?
Oh, one of the other big things is we were hoping to add a plugin API. One of the big things lacking is people who want to use ICC support on the desktop. So for people who use software calibration pucks and so on. Right now, there's no clear way to plug those ICC profiles into OpenColor where it just sort of works across the applications. We're hoping to get that in there. And then finally, the configurations that ship with OpenColor. I mean, the ACES one, for example, they're still sort of work-in-progress prototypes. We'd really love to do another round and to put out what I would call like the final best practice for modern color management, color configurations that people can use.
Yeah, and as we were joking before, ACES isn't fully published yet. So for all we know, there'll be some other variations in how they do things, maybe with some of the output transforms.
Exactly.
How much is Sony still having to do the heavy lifting in terms of the open source community? Do you have much contribution from other companies?
We do. We've had a lot of really good contributions in the last few years. I would say at this point, it's definitely a 50-50 split inside versus outside.
And as I understand it, your internal initiatives with open source, I mean, you don't take from the open source and then sort of do your own internal stuff. Like when you actually do internal updates, they basically get republished almost directly back into the open source community. In fact, Sony isn't operating it at arm's length. It's totally embracing it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, there is no internal branch of any of our open source projects. I think, certainly with OpenColor.io, that's a very stable piece of software. But I think one of the most exciting examples of that is OSL, the open shading language, where literally the exciting things that Larry works on this week get committed to open source and then rolled into production the following week. Or I should say a development production branch, right? But, like, there's no sort of super secret internal version for the open source projects themselves.
So if you want to learn more about it, there's the OpenColor.io site, but there's also the cinematiccolor.com site. Do you want to explain those two?
Yeah, so cinematiccolor.com was a course we started at SIGGRAPH last year, which sort of focused on the philosophy and the principles behind just modern color management, like a seen linear color workflows. It sort of clarifies the difference between like on-set color management and scene-referred spaces versus display-referred spaces, where you start talking about words like gamma. And I think it sort of focuses on the importance of using a viewing transform, specifically an S-shaped viewing transform, when viewing the high dynamic range imagery. It sort of teaches you all the things to put in context, the principles that are embodied in OpenColor.io's approach. And then this, in addition to that website, the VES Technology Committee, the Visual Effects Society, picked it up and released the course notes for that as a white paper, which we then further augmented and added a few additional sections. And it's really taken off. So there's, a 60-page PDF available for download for free from cinematiccolor.com.
Yeah, well, I think there are actually two. There's your original SIGGRAPH paper and the VES one, but you don't have to be a VES member to download it.
No, it's freely available. And we hope to have a new version which fixes many of the typos and erratas in the near future.
I was also pleased to see, and of course there's a rigorous process for SIGGRAPH, but I was also pleased to see the kind of review process that the VES Technical Committee had done on that as well, because there's some good names there just in the review committee.
Yeah, it was actually very intimidating to send them all this PDF course notes and to get back feedback, because of course all of it was accurate and helpful and wonderful, but it can be intimidating at times with that many big names picking apart something you've written.
So early February, you turn up at the Academy for the SciTech, but of course, old hat for you after last year.
Oh, yeah. Well, that doesn't mean it's not exciting. It's actually just a wonderful event to go to because unlike the more traditional Academy Awards, the SciTech Awards, everybody's already won, so there's really no surprises ahead of time. So it's just a really joyful celebration of old faces and new ones.
Well, plus there's a lot of good people in the room, right? So
yeah,
drinks
exactly.
Beforehand and after are often very, very good.
So this year there were a lot of awardees, so it's going to be a long alcoholic evening that I look forward to.
Yeah, no, it is good. And of course, the SciTech Award people outside just what I'm going to call the digital side of visual effects stuff. There are terrific people recognized in other related areas. But you're right, there are a lot of what you'd call our people at the SciTech this year.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us, and congratulations again. And we'll put a link up where people can go over to Cinematic Color to download that 6-gig PDF.
Great. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks to Mike and Jeremy for that. Over the years, people have asked us, how can we help FX Guide? How can we make it possible for you to keep bringing us all this great content for free? Well, we've created the FX Insider membership program that offers insiders exclusive access to content and expanded articles. It's a way for people who care about what we do here at FX Guide and visual effects to help us continue to grow. Details are at fxguide.com. Click the FX Insider tab. And thanks to all of you who have already become FX Insider members. You've been listening to the FX Podcast, and as I mentioned at the beginning, we also produce other audio podcasts. One in particular, The VFX Show, reviews visual effects and current releases. This is visual effects artists sitting around discussing the visual effects and current, as well as classic films. We also produce the RC Podcast, which covers digital cinematography. Obviously, if you've been listening to this interview, you're aware of all the flood of cameras that keep coming out and the changing of that, and Jason Wingrove and Mike Seymour try to keep you up to date on all of that. We also produced FX Guide TV, a high-definition video podcast, and you can find all of these along with in-depth articles, news, and more at fxguide.com. And as I mentioned, we also have our sister site, fxphd.com, with extensive online visual effects training. That'll do it for this episode. For my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, I'm Jeff Huser. We'll see you on the next FX Podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.